It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Big story of the day. Governor of New York, a little trouble. I think now's the time Andrew Cuomo got to go. When the allegations were unsubstantiated, when there was no investigation, you go, okay, let it play out. They've now run an investigation. They've deemed that he toxic workplace. They deemed he's done some harassment things. We can go back and we can fight and we can argue about what those things were. It's now clear he did something. He said he would go. He said that he was going to, the end. President Biden has called on him to resign. Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, both said he should go. It's time. It's time to go. Now he's saying, look, I didn't do anything wrong. Did nothing wrong. What I found interesting, and this is one of those things I think is kind of strange. He goes on this thing about, you know, not understanding, you know, the cultural norms and he's not learned his lesson, won't do it again. Pinky swear, promise, raise hand. And I do think, I think he's from a different era where the kind of stuff that he thinks is normal is in this moment not appropriate. And it just is what it is. Now, my Republican friends, they would be applauding this behavior, and there's no way he would be resigning. It's the difference in the sensibilities on each side. In fact, I can't in good conscience look at Cuomo and go, you know, you got to go. But Matt Gaetz, who is accused of having sex with a minor, should be in jail if that's true. While that investigation is still dragging its feet along, and all of the litany of charges that he's been accused of, they're two very different series of crimes, but you don't hear anyone on the right calling for Matt Gaetz's resignation. And it's a difference in how you want to run the country and how things should be. On the left, you know, the Democrats are saying, look, we don't want to have politicians. Some are saying we don't want to have politicians who act in this behavior. Going to be interesting to see how the pressure builds from this point, because I didn't anticipate Cuomo going, oh, okay, yeah, I'll leave now. We'll see how it plays out. We'll see how much louder the voices go, and we'll go from there. For me, at this point, it's time. Yeah, you said you were going to go. The investigation is done. It is what it is. Again, difference between the right and the left. Also, here we go again. The masks, I guess, are coming back. Only this time, there aren't going to... And I've been saying this for a while. There's not going to be another lockdown. There's not going to be another government-led lockdown where we say, you have to do it. There's not going to be that anymore, because clearly we're not responsible enough to do it. Clearly we're not big boys and girls. And we, like children, we will be outwardly defiant of what is in our best interests just because mom and dad said, don't do it. Anybody who's a parent knows, you tell a two-year-old, no, don't do that. The second you turn your back, what are they doing? Exactly what you put in front of them and said, don't do. Now what's happening is corporate America is saying, well, we got to do something. You're seeing Costco, you're seeing Target, Kroger, Walmart, even Apple changing their mask policies. As the CDC is now saying, look, you know, we've got to go back and wear these masks again, because this Delta variant is exploding. You also had New York Mayor Bill de Blasio recommending that the 8 million citizens in the city of New York wear masks indoors, regardless of your vaccination status. But it looks like now it's corporate America that's going to be moving heavily into that direction. Because, you know, and I've been saying this from the beginning, those places that didn't protect their workers, people who got sick on the job with the virus, should be filing workers' comp claims. Should, it's a work-related industry injury. If your employer is not keeping you safe, you should have some recourse. And now employers are going, hey, you know, government's no longer going to be responsible. We can't point to them and go, it's that bad, them. It may come back and bite us. So now they're going back and saying, you know, no vax, no service. That is the new sign. No shirt, no shoes, no vax, no service. No mask, no service. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out as employers are mandating that their employees get vaccinated and customers wear masks. You know, I go back to what I said at the beginning when this first hit. And again, it goes back to how much I value the relationship I have with my personal doctor, with our family doctor, who said from 6 months from the day they tell you you don't have to wear them, he'll still be wearing them. And, you know, we're almost 6 months past that. It's been 3-4 months since they said, yeah, it's okay. I know my wife's giving me the, you know, no, it's not, you're wrong. I'm going to look that up. But, you know, it's one of those things where he was right. And it's something that we should be doing. Now, Tyson Foods, the meatpacking plant, Tyson, they are mandating that the vaccines are taken by their employees. So Tyson, you know, the place where they were out there, their supervisors were betting on how many people they could get sick. They're mandating that the workforce has to be vaccinated because, look, here again, evidently this is just spreading like wildfire. And we'll see where it goes. I mean, you know, I've said for a while, we're going to have to power through this because we're not big boys and girls. We're all going to have to get through this one way or another. But good on them. Now I got to point to California. Something today that for me, even bigger than the employers saying, hey, all of our employees got to be vaccinated. Which, again, this is an interesting moment because the federal government's saying, yeah, okay, we're in favor of that. Biden said he's in favor of it. A lot of legal scholars are saying, yep, it's in their wheelhouse. They can do it. Gonna be interesting to see how some of these far right wing groups handle this. Whether we're gonna see you know angry protests, whether we're gonna see lawsuits, all of the above. Gonna be interesting to see where that goes. But beyond, you know, the variant part and Andrew Cuomo, I'm looking out at California at this recall election, which is just getting, you know, crazier and crazier as one of the leading candidates out there, a guy who could possibly become the next governor of California, Larry Elder, who is a radio talk show host. He was a columnist for a while, but he's a syndicated radio guy. I've known of him for a long time. Way out on the conservative fringe. He's one of those guys. I'm not going to put him in the crazy fringe, but out on the conservative fringe. Government should do nothing. Everything should be the free market and the private sector and that old school kind of conservative, but only to the extreme. To where old school conservatives would go, yeah, you got to have something that's going to dull the blades of capitalism. There's got to be something there that protects the folks at the bottom. We got to have something there for people so that they don't revolt, so they don't get out the pitchforks and come storming the Bastille, so to speak. Not Larry Elder. Larry was asked about the minimum wage. He was discussing a bunch of issues. Minimum wage came up, and according to Larry, the $14 an hour minimum wage that California has for employers with more than 26 employees and 13 for less than 26 employees, evidently that's just way too high. And you go, well, how much too high? According to Larry Elder, the ideal minimum wage for Larry Elder is nothing. No minimum wage whatsoever, because he believes, and I love this white ivory tower kind of thinking. I love this purely academic, you know, rice and beans kind of mindset. He says why people who are adults can't determine the price of labor, what the price of labor ought to be, is beyond me. He says why a third party feels it is his or her business to interfere with that is also beyond me. You know, I'm reading this and I'm going, really? It's beyond you? You really can't see how there's a massive imbalance of power? You really can't see that right now we've had 40 plus years of supply side voodoo Reaganomics that has crushed wages, has given massive tax breaks to corporate America and massive power. You can't see that we're re-monopolizing. You can't see that we're reliving the Gilded Age, where we have an extraordinarily powerful elite class and a very large poverty class. You can't see, and then you can't see how one could have power and sway over the other. You really can't see that. You can't see that they're not on equal footing, because this all stems from this free market thinking. That, understand, in a free market, you have to have the ability to abstain. So working people don't have the ability to go, screw it, not working. They don't have that ability. They have to work. The employers can go, I don't need anybody. I've got all the money I need. I don't need anything. So there's a massive imbalance of power. And oh, by the way, we have a glut of employment, and a glut of employees. And when we don't, we just bring some more in from other places. You think our immigration policies have anything to do with the fact that corporate America has been advertising in third world countries for years going, hey, come here and we'll give you a job. Come here and you can make X amount of dollars. You don't think that that's a huge part of our immigration problem? And the fact that our trade policy has been crushing other countries' ability to provide employment for their workers. You don't think that has something to do with it? All while we're feeding the very wealthy and ensuring that they never have to work a day in their life. But I saw this quote and it just sent me into a tizzy. I mean, it's one of those things where you go, there aren't enough F letters to go around when I saw this, and I'm still struggling not to go off on a tirade over the fact that this is somebody who could potentially could become the next governor of Florida who has this kind of bizarre ideology and lack of understanding of what average everyday working people go through, you know, because these are people who believe that you can go in and negotiate your wage. You can go into the McDonald's or the Walmart or the wherever or the, you know, John's, you know, gas station or, you know, anywhere. You can go into these places and say, no, you're offering $8 an hour. I want 10 or no, I want, you know, I want $27 plus blah, 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 blah. And they think you have that kind of power. You don't. And you know that. And I think they know that. The one thing that conservative radio has been masterful at is pumping up people's egos and their self-worth. I actually know union guys, union brothers who think that in the place where they work, they would make more money and have better, you know, everything without the union there. Now, there are only a few, but I do know people who have told me that over the years. We'd be so much better off. And you go, well, where is that in reality, in the real world? I know you've been listening to all that blather on the radio, and I know you've been listening to them tell you how wonderful and smart and build up your self-worth. But where in reality is what you're talking about? And this is the thing that gets me. Where in reality do workers and capitalists, where does capital and labor play on an even playing field? They don't, unless you get to the very top, where you're the most skilled in your field, you're one of, you know, you're the one in a million. Where do you get that? For the mass of workers, the people who are worried about minimum wage and just above, There's no bargaining for that, and he knows that. This is about making even more the minimum wage, even more of a poverty wage. Now, in the place where workers and capital are somewhere near even is if you have a union contract. You sit down and you negotiate as near equals. Not equals, near. The employer still knows they've got an upper hand. But at least there's some bargaining ability. When it's the individual against the monopoly, you know, how many people walk into Amazon and go, no, I know you say $15 now, I want $20. And Amazon goes, let me call Jeff and find out. And then he comes back, yeah, Jeff said okay. Never going to happen. And Larry Elder knows that. And I did find the other part of his interview interesting. He said that there was a gentleman that came out of Hollywood who was not on talk radio for 27 years, as I have been. I was not in every major market in California from Sacramento down to San Diego. Not like I have been for 23 years. He came out of Hollywood and he was a pretty good two-term governor and a pretty damn good president, he said. Of course, he's talking about, I don't know, because I don't know who was that good two-term president that came out of Hollywood. There was that crummy one that caused a lot of our problems. There was Ronald Reagan. Not quite sure who he's talking about. Although he says, I'm not comparing myself to Ronald Reagan, while trying to compare himself to Ronald Reagan. Although he did say the comparison is sometimes political experience doesn't tell you anything. And it's his justification for not actually knowing how to run anything. Give him credit. Use what you can. It is what it is. I'm looking at California in, with kind of an interested eye. Because right now, 47% of likely voters support removing Gavin Newsom. 50% are looking to keep him. And I think the more Larry Elder talks, the more that we hear his ideas, the more that 50% of we should just keep what we've got will probably go up. So, you know, keep going, Larry. Good luck. I guess it's probably going to be good for ratings or something down the road. But, these are who some of these people are, man. Scary, scary times. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Morris Pearl, the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaire, is going to be here to share some thoughts on the potential of, you know, let's throw a bunch of people out of their homes. Right back after this. More American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. That was the day 13,000 workers in the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, or PATCO, went out on strike. Highly stressed workers had been driven to nervous exhaustion by long hours, problematic technology, and brutal management. They wanted better pay and working conditions and a 32-hour work week. PATCO workers had proven that militancy bred victories throughout the 1970s. But public sector employers went on the offensive as the decade drew to a close. By the time Ronald Reagan was elected to office, automation, deregulation, and inflation had taken its toll. As Joseph McCartan details in his book Collision Course, controllers found new technology unreliable. They experienced, on average, a computer outage a day in critical moments of takeoffs and landings. As well, the Airline Deregulation Act and the Civil Service Reform Act became law in October 1978, serving to restrict union rights and worsen working conditions. By the late 1970s, inflation had tripled. Federal workers, unlike those in the private sector, lacked any COLA protections. Emboldened by their skill level, solidarity, and previous victories, the controllers walked. Invoking Taft-Hartley, President Reagan issued a 48-hour back-to-work ultimatum. In a historic move, he fired the strikers, jailed their leaders, and forced costly injunctions that spelled doom for the union and the labor movement. Many labor activists had hoped the Teamsters and machinists would walk out in support. Instead, the strike was a pivotal moment for labor. It ushered in an era of unprecedented attacks not seen since the 1930s. As Robert Weir notes, PATCO's defeat touched off a new wave of downsizing, decertification, and concession strikes. The labor movement continues to suffer its impact today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, the last couple of days of people, you know, shouting and screaming at the administration that they allowed this eviction moratorium to basically just go wild as Congress was heading for the exit, has yielded some movement, as Joe Biden today came out and has announced a new 2-month eviction moratorium. But I guess the caveat in this is it's only in the places that are being hit hardest by the new wave of infections. And I'm going, why are we rewarding those who are doing the worst things? And now look, these are poor people in every state who don't have control over this. But, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's just angering. You should have just made it across the country. We're just going to make sure everybody gets to stay in their homes, not just those states where you've got morons running around. Just my thoughts. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on this new decision and whether, you know, Congress should have left before actually doing something. I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. Check out their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's great to be on your show. Thank you.
So I'm looking at, you know, Biden's decision today. It's the right decision, extended for 2 months. I just don't know why we had to put the caveat in there that it's only in those places where things are raging.
I think there's really two different groups of people looking at this. There's one group, most Democrats and most people, who are saying, look, we don't want to evict people in the middle of this pandemic where thousands of people have lost, millions of people have lost their jobs and all kinds of horrible things are happening. And there's this other side saying, oh, no, government's not supposed to be helping people. Government's just supposed to be doing these very limited things that the founding fathers had in mind back in the 18th century. And so they've come up with this rule, oh, it's to stop the spread of diseases, not evicting people, because then they'll have to move. So they've done just the part that they can kind of justify on the basis of something that, you know, these 18th century founding fathers would have understood. And I mean, I agree with you. I think it's ridiculous that we, our government, who's trying to do the right thing for people, or supposed to be doing the right thing for people, is feeling constrained by just, I don't know what, just, it's just ridiculous. I agree.
Now, as I understand, there's $46.5 billion out there to help renters. We talked to a state senator here from Pennsylvania last night who came out and said, look, you know, the money is coming. We just can't get it out the door fast enough. It's a problem of getting the resources to help these people already. So it just seems to me like, you know, throwing people out of their homes at this moment, it seems like kind of a dumb idea when there is help on the way.
It is a dumb idea. It's a dumb idea most times, and not just because we care about those people being thrown out of their homes, but we do, but we care about their landlords. We don't want them losing money too. There's plenty of mom and pop landlords who don't have any income either. And we care about the guys who own all the businesses these people shopped. We know we care about the bartenders who used to get tips on Friday nights from these guys. And we care about their communities, because whole communities fall apart when people are getting evicted and losing their homes, and all the things that put the community together are kind of falling apart. And right. Frankly, it's part of our society's job to prevent that.
Yeah, I mean, did we not learn that lesson in 2009 and 10? When places like Cleveland and Detroit and Milwaukee, you know, basically had entire neighborhoods wiped out as you know, people lost their homes and then ended up, I know where I lived in Cleveland, they actually bulldozed, you know, parts of neighborhoods because the houses were all, you know, ripped to shreds or, you know, in disrepair, beyond repair is better. And did we not learn from that?
We should have, because only a small number of those people actually had these subprime toxic mortgages or whatever. But a huge number of people were caught up in the side effects of that, in the cycles that go through neighborhoods, because they work in the real estate industry, because they work in some other industry that depends on those people, because of so many other things. And it affected hugely more people than the relatively small number of people that actually could not make their mortgage payments.
Yeah, and that's where I'm kind of in this spot right now. It seems to me that we should be doing something. I found it weird that the CDC is the one who came out with the moratorium. I come back to this idea. Isn't that Congress's job? Isn't this something that they should have done, you know, last year first, and then, you know, now before they went on vacation?
Well, frankly, I agree with you. I would have preferred that Congress pass some law about this, and not just saying no evictions, but actually providing money to pay people's rents, because it's not like we want to ask landlords to take all the brunt of the problem here.
Right, because they can't.
Yes, and they can't. A lot of them, I mean, some of them are doing great. I'm sure there are a few landlords who are doing great, but there are plenty who are struggling too, just like everyone else. There are plenty of rental houses that are owned by someone who just owns one and depends on that for his or her retirement income, that rent. So yeah, I think we need to get those billions of dollars that have already been allocated out to the right people.
Yeah, and then again, that takes time to do. And now all of this comes back down to the fact that our Supreme Court basically threw out the CDC's moratorium and put us in this position, right?
I think they're trying to, the Supreme Court is trying to say that we want to run the country just as those people over 200 years ago intended. And they intended for a lot of things that I don't think are right now. Things like, you know, slavery and only men who own property voting and a lot of things that, frankly, we don't believe are the right thing today. And so I don't think that the Supreme Court, with a few guys who try to think out what did they mean when they signed this thing in Philadelphia's Independence Hall back in the day, I don't think that's the right criteria for making decisions personally.
So you think this is going to be enough? Because, you know, there are some, I have some activist friends who are concerned that, you know, we're going to see the kind of evictions that we saw, you know, back in 9 and 10 with the foreclosures that happened, you know, where, you know, people are going to come home and find all their stuff out on the lawn or out on the street corner. Do you fear that's coming, or do you think that this can hold that down for a bit?
I mean, I'm afraid of that too. This, the new rule that the administration put out doesn't apply to the whole country, I don't think. Yeah, so yeah, I'm afraid of that. And even in the best of times, there's some people being evicted for whatever. So it's not just because of pandemics. But yeah, I'm afraid of that. I hope that this new order, well, it's better than nothing, certainly. So I'll give them some credit. But, you know, I think we need more. I would have preferred Congress acting on this, as I think many members of Congress would have preferred too.
Yeah, it just seemed like bad messaging. You had like the perfect storm over the weekend of, you know, the Democrats leaving town and President Obama, you know, going to have his 60th birthday party and all the messaging that goes around that. It just looked like a really bad time for the poor.
I'm not going to President Obama's 60th birthday party. I've not been to any of his other birthday parties either. So I will, I'm just on a, you know, taking a few days off with my family. Just up in upstate New York, not too far from where I live.
Yeah, I didn't get an invitation to the big shindig, and I personally wouldn't go anyway. But you know, it's just the messaging that comes out of that is what's kind of frustrating to me, because there is so much that has to be done, and so much that's not. Now, as you've said, you know, there are people out there who they just think that, hey, well, you didn't pay your rent, throw people to the curb, and there are a lot of corporations right now, some of these hedge funds, who are buying up single family homes that have a lot of people, you know, kind of concerned on what the future of rentals are going to be in this country. And it seems like this is like that perfect storm moment where we're going to have a whole bunch of landlords really desperate to sell and get out, and, you know, easy pickings.
Well, I mean, I think it makes sense for more rental housing to be available. I think for some people, they want to live in a house, not an apartment, but yet they want some flexibility. They think they might want to live someplace for only 1 year or 2 years or something. So I think it's good that there's rental houses available. But no, I don't think it's good if a few landlords control all of the housing. No, I think that could be a problem for America. That's, you know, what they went to war over in Ireland not right that long ago.
Ultimately, this is about getting the economy back going, though, and I keep coming back to the infrastructure bill. A booming economy solves a lot of problems. When you get people back to work in good wage jobs, they get to pay their rent, they get to keep food on the table. A lot of good things happen, which is why, again, you know, we've got this vacation period without an infrastructure bill, without anything getting out the door and jobs being created and industries being shored up. Again, this to me is another failure of leadership that they should not have left until that was done.
I agree with the point that you made that what gets the economy going is all those people with good jobs, because they're the ones who are buying things. They're the ones who are paying their rent and their iPhone bill and all their other bills every month. And they're the ones that keep all the businesses and all the main streets in America going. So yeah, I think that's where the focus should be. And I frankly don't really care much about what happens to the few billionaires.
Yeah, and ultimately your organization is one of those that is saying we need to tax them more, take that money and invest it in things like infrastructure so we rebuild our economy. But more importantly, we give people those jobs to help reinvigorate our economy and help people stay in their homes. It seems like a good idea. Maybe we should try it.
Part of our problem is that we have too much of our tax burden is on regular middle class people who have to work for a living. You know, talk to your business owners, even in Pennsylvania, and the guy who owns the bar is more worried about how much beer money all the people sitting in the bar have on a Friday night than about the wages of the one guy who's standing behind the bar pouring the beer. So it's middle class Americans who have jobs who are making America run.
That is an excellent point. Now, on this eviction moratorium front, I understand you guys have signed on with a bunch of other groups for this next Friday, I believe it is, for a concert for jobs, climate, and care. I guess it's a free concert. I guess tickets are limited. You can go to your website, patrioticmillionaires.org, and you'll also be live streaming this through your social media sites. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, from Fairmont Park in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. So, yeah, I mean, is a concert going to solve all the problems? No, but it's one step in getting the word out there and getting people to understand what the problems are, and that they can have a role in fixing the problems by getting their elected representatives to do what they want done.
Yeah, absolutely. To raise awareness and maybe a little bit of money. It's a free concert, but there's got to be a way to donate to help. Is that part of this plan too?
Yeah, take a look at our website. You're free to send in some money. And I believe we're going to have a team there selling Tax the Rich t-shirts.
All right, that's good stuff. Now, as we talked yesterday to our local state senator, he said, "Look, you know, if you're up against it, if you're behind on your rent, make sure you fill out the forms in your county. Make sure that you seek out the rental assistance forms. And if you need legal assistance during foreclosure, go to legal aid or someone. But don't allow yourself to go into a courtroom without legal advice." And I think it's both good things and things that they have to remember. Because after all, being foreclosed on, being evicted, those are legal procedures. You need a lawyer. But Morris, I also wanted to get your thoughts on this Larry Elder. I don't know if you know who Larry Elder is. He's a talk show host from out West Coast. He said today that it's been reported that he believes the right minimum wage, the ideal minimum wage, is zero. And to him, he can't understand why two people who are adults can't determine what the price of labor ought to be. To him, it's beyond him. He says he feels a third party. It's not their business. Again, he doesn't understand. It's beyond him. Is the ideal minimum wage zero?
I don't think so, Rick. I really don't. We've decided in 1865 that we had to have some government regulation on labor. Labor is not strictly a free market. You know, when this country was founded, people went to Africa and kidnapped people and got them to work for zero. We decided that's not the way we want things to run in our country, and we changed the rules. Labor is not the same kind of free market as, you know, selling wheat from a wheat farmer is. It's hours of work of people, and people cannot just sell their labor back and forth however they want. It's never been a free market. It's always been regulated by governments here and around the world since biblical times. And no, we need it still needs to be regulated.
No, you're absolutely. And I have a lot of gig employee friends who they believe, they go to these gig apps and they pick up jobs and they basically slit each other's throats for pennies, but they all get some kind of jobs. And they think that they're negotiating for their labor when actually what they're doing is they're negotiating their labor down. And a lot of them, I don't think they actually understand that.
Look, some people, that's what they want to do. But there's plenty of people getting money from these gig apps that would truly rather have an actual paycheck every week. We sort of found, back in the early part of the 20th century, people in lower Manhattan were doing piecework work, and they were working in sweatshops, and that's where the term came from. And we had fires like the Triangle Shirt Factory fire, and we came with regulations. We no longer allow people to do piecework work because there's a very few companies that actually employ people. There's a very few companies that people can actually go to do the work. And it used to be a few garment manufacturers, and now it's Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and Instacart and probably another few beyond that. But they don't, all the people who work there don't have the negotiating power. It's not a simple exchange between peers of two parties coming to an agreement because one party has far more power than the other party. So to call this a free market is totally making ridiculous meaning of the term. So
No.
no, we do need regulation of labor market in the United States.
No, I mean, in order to have a free market, you have to, as I said earlier, you have to be able to abstain. You have to be able to go, no, I'm not going to work. And I don't know many working people who can go. Now, you, on the other hand, you could go, I'm not, I don't need it. I'm not doing it. I got better things to do. But the average everyday working person, they can't say, I abstain.
I did. I mean, in 2014, I decided I done as much as I needed to do for the shareholders of the company I used to work for. But I was very lucky to be in a situation where I don't need to work for a living. I have enough money. I'm on vacation. I sort of hesitate to use the word because I don't actually work. So what am I on vacation from? But yeah, I'm on vacation now.
Well, good for you, man.
So
But I love the work that you do over at Patriotic Millionaires. I think it's important work. I think getting out there and telling the story that of what you've done and saying, look, I'm a guy who, I won the game, but I want you to do well too, I think is really important. So I appreciate you taking
because we're
time for
all
us.
going to do well. If we all do well, we all do well. It's
Yeah,
true.
that old saying, when we all do better, we'll all do better when we all do better. Good stuff. Morris, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will take a look at the website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Check out the free concert in Philadelphia on February 13th. You can also, if you're not in Philly, you can watch it via live
August.
stream. All good stuff.
August, not February.
Did I say February? I said
Yeah,
Friday. Friday,
you
August
misspoke.
13th. Sorry.
Friday. Thank
Friday,
you.
August 13th. February is a long day down the way. Morris, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Morris Pearl, chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. Friday, August 13th. Make sure you check out their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day that became known in California as the Wheatland Riot. The Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, were trying to organize hop pickers who worked near the city of Wheatland in Northern California. Living conditions for the hop pickers were rough. Durst Ranch was the largest agricultural employer in the state, hiring hundreds of seasonal farm workers each summer. The Durst workers slept in tents. The bathrooms were latrine ditches dug into the ground. The well water they drank was contaminated and foul. The Northern California heat was excruciating, with temperatures soaring above 100 degrees. And while the temperatures were high, the wages were unbearably low. On this fateful day, thousands of workers gathered to hear IWW organizer Richard Ford talk about calling a strike. In response, the local sheriff formed a posse to arrest Ford. During the arrest, one of the posse shot his gun into the air to disperse the crowd. Chaos erupted. Gunfire was exchanged. Four people lay dead, including the district attorney, a deputy sheriff, a worker, and a young boy. Authorities blamed the IWW for the violence.
Ford stood trial for causing the riot, even though he had fired no shots. Another Wobbly organizer, who was not even there that day, was also tried for the events at Wheatland. Both received sentences of life in prison for second-degree murder. Today, an historic marker commemorates the site. It explains that the event, quote, focused public opinion for the first time on the plight of California's agricultural laborers and resulted in new state legislation to regulate labor camp conditions. A new state commission on immigration and housing was created to improve working conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I saw a story today that they're evidently going to be reopening parts of Sparrows Point in Baltimore, going to bring some steel production back, which, wow, jobs most certainly needed, especially now. But when you read into the article, they're getting ready to start, according to this report, start building, you know, wind turbines and the steel that they need for all that stuff for offshore wind turbines. This is as we're remaking the economy, once we get an infrastructure bill, once we start moving towards the energy of the future, there will be jobs created out of it. And this is, seems like a good first step. I'm here to share some thoughts on how this happened, why, and what it's going to do. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you. And that is truly great news for Baltimore. It's been a long time coming.
Now, I mean, this is if anyone's been over there, this is an enormous facility. And the fact that it was just... it's over. Yeah, you know, thousands of people lost jobs. The community lost revenue. It was a terrible thing. I'm glad to see that we're starting to produce things again.
Yeah, and for your listeners, I guess, who don't know about Sparrows Point, you know, it has a long and important history. I mean, it used to be Bethlehem Steel, and it made many of the battleships that the U.S. floated in World War II. Just was churning them out like crazy. When Bethlehem Steel went bankrupt, the mill downsized. It was eventually bought by a Russian company, but they transferred ownership to ArcelorMittal, and then it closed down, and then it was pretty dormant for a long time. And you're right. This was a diverse workforce. There were black and white workers there. The community around it was entirely dependent on those well-paying jobs. And so having this come online is an important step in recovery. And I just like it for this reason, because it ties together a number of the themes that Joe Biden has been talking about. And one is a clean energy future. This investment wouldn't have happened without there being a market for offshore wind towers in the United States. So that's number one. Number two is steel tariffs. You know, if a company wanted to try to lowball things, they try to get the steel from China, right, or another country that has worse labor and environmental conditions or subsidizes the industry. I'm glad that the steel tariffs are in place. Number three is that these are going to be union jobs. This is going to be a steel worker represented facility, which is also fantastic news. And the last piece of this is that because of a lot of this offshore wind requires federal regulation, there is some subsidy with it. There is a Buy America component as well. And so one of the great reasons why we're able to make this investment in Baltimore is that we know that the federal government is going to want these offshore wind farms that are coming online to be manufactured in the United States of America and not overseas.
Yeah, and I argue that this is part of, as you've pointed out, it's part of the Biden agenda. It's part of this Build Back Better plan. And talking about renewable energies, and it reminds me of, you know, back during the beginning of the Obama term, when there was talk of, you know, where they invested heavily in solar and in wind. You know, here in Pennsylvania, there was a, they started making the blades for the wind turbines. They started doing a bunch of stuff.
That's right. They sure did. And it was Gamesa was the company, I think, in both in Western Pennsylvania and outside of Philadelphia. The challenge is that there was pushback against these types of renewable energy standards that happened at the state level. There was pushback against subsidies at the federal level from the Republicans, and it was hard to sustain all of that. And we've talked about this before. I mean, we know we need to get to a clean energy future sooner rather than later for a lot of different reasons. But we have to do it in a way that's sustainable, that creates jobs in the United States, in a way that's not just trading foreign oil for made in China solar panels or made in Europe wind turbines. And so I think that the way that this administration is going about it is the smart way to proceed, is that you have to build up the demand, but you also have to insist that these are good jobs and that the products are coming from the United States of America as well.
Now, this is something you follow, you know, quite extensively, the trade policies and manufacturing policy for the country. And I've been saying for the longest time that we need to return to an idea of domestic production for domestic consumption. And we're seeing a lot of places around the world that are trying to, you know, it looks like they're trying to undo this, you know, this free trade mantra that has put us in this situation. I'm not against trade. I'm against race to the bottom kind of trade that we end up producing all the things we need in the cheapest, most exploitable places possible. But we have to do protect some stuff. And I'm looking at, you know, Mexico, for instance, who's saying, you know, they're going to move away from GMO corn and corn made with this glyphosate. It seems like they're trying to gain some control over their industries as well, agricultural being one of them. Do you agree that maybe we're seeing some of the breakup of this free trade mantra that we had during the neoliberal era?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a couple of things going on here, and they're converging at this time. But, you know, the pandemic certainly brought into focus that even countries like the United States that are incredibly well developed have shortfalls and don't have full supply chains and capabilities when it comes to some key things that we need, that we take for granted: medicine, PPE, semiconductor chips. You know, all of this is none of us think about this, you know, on a daily basis. But in the business supply chain world, or if you're trying to prepare for a pandemic, you need to be on top of this stuff. And we discovered a lot of shortfalls, and we weren't alone. So I think that there's countries around the world that are doing that. Number two, I think that there is a greater awareness that the rules of trade are skewed. And, you know, to Trump's credit, and we've talked about this before, he understood the rules were skewed. He didn't have a great idea about how to unwind all of that, because fundamentally, I don't think he's about, you know, protecting the environment or working people. You know, he was mostly a demagogue about that, but he identified some of the problems, and he wasn't alone. As you pointed out, Mexico realizes this. A couple of other countries have realized and gone down this path as well. And then, Rick, the other thing that we have seen, in addition to this awareness that the multinational companies all over the world have been writing the rules at the expense of workers and the environment, is the fact that the theory itself kind of didn't work out. It kind of didn't work out. I mean, yeah, we got a ton of cheap T-shirts to choose from, but wages, didn't make gains for so long. And we didn't spread democracy through free trade. In fact, the opposite happened when it came to China. Chinese government got enriched and it got meaner,
right,
in a lot of different ways. So all of this kind of like all of these kind of myths shattered at the same time. And so I do think, you know, again, I like the way that Biden and his team are approaching this, which is, you know, we may not do things the way Trump did them exactly, but we're certainly not going to go back and do it the way Obama did it or Clinton did it and repeat those mistakes as well. We need to chart a new path, one that puts workers at the center of all of.
No, I'm right there.
And you're right. I think, you know, if other countries do the same thing and put their workers first, we're all going to be better off.
No, I'm right. I'm right there, because the reason that you said a second ago that the plan hasn't worked, and I maybe the jaded side of me disagrees with that, because I think it worked perfectly. I think it worked exactly how it was supposed to work, which is to make these huge multinational corporations enormous sums of wealth and giving them enormous power over, it doesn't matter which government. And I forget offhand which CEO said it, but he said he didn't want to be part of any country. He wanted to operate it off of an island so he didn't have to pay taxes to anyone or listen to anyone or be controlled by anyone. He wanted to be the power. I remember that quote often because This is what we've given corporate America. We've given them the power to basically, you know, flip their nose at us.
Yeah, I think that was Jack Welch from GE, right. if I'm not mistaken. And yeah, he totally bought into this. And you're right. I should have been more precise with my words. So you're right. The multinational companies that were writing the rules, you're right. This went according to plan. You're 100% correct about that. Workers got screwed. Shareholders got rich, and we really didn't make that progress. Now the other matter is this theory, and free trade theory, and I think that's what's been called a little bit into question because it does make sense to trade, and it can be mutually beneficial to do that. But what has happened, Rick, in all of this is that no one wants to talk about the underbelly of free trade and the side effects of it, and those were kind of swept under the carpet, and now they're not, right. Which I think is good.
No, I go back to when I learned about, you know, basic economic stuff years and years ago when this whole free trade thing was just percolating, and they were saying, you know, they always use the phrase all things considered equal, which was one of my favorite economic terms. You know, all things considered equal. Yeah. Well, they're not equal. We're never going to have equal environment with China. So you can't say trade between the U.S. Right. and China is good, all things considered equal, because it's never going to be considered equal.
Yeah, I don't want to wonk out here, but the assumptions were always everybody has access to the same complete information, number right. one. Number two, they assume there's full employment in all of their models as well. So and there's a bunch of other stuff as well. It was kind of ridiculous the way that this was sold. But again, I think that there is a reassessment of this. There will certainly be pushback, and you know, corporate Democrats, corporate Republicans will try to rise again, and we'll see that all the time. But I do think that we've seen this fundamental shift, and it is happening not only in the United States, but in some of the other countries who are allied with us as well.
I mean, we're seeing populist uprisings, you know, and sadly how they've turned out so far is you've got some, I don't know how a New York billionaire gets to lead the front of a populist uprising.
Right.
But, you know, you were right. He did point out what is wrong, and Biden has to go and fix some of that. And manufacturing was a big part of those complaints. But, you know, I'm looking at the numbers and, you know, AP just came out with a story, I guess it was yesterday. That said, you know, July, our manufacturing expanded again, but it actually, the pace slowed based on this Institute for Supply Management Group's index to where we've kind of slid back the last couple of months. And I keep going, we need an infrastructure plan, Scott.
Yeah.
Why did the Democrats leave without getting that on Biden's desk?
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, I do think that, you know, so here's, you know, I know there's a lot of opinions about the bipartisan infrastructure framework that was agreed to by the White House and the group of senators. I think it's an important step, and I think that it's got to get passed here. I think it's got to get passed. The House has passed a big investment, and let's move this. And I think that that's the type of thing that we need to build the post-COVID momentum, whenever that occurs, of course, in this economy. Because, again, the private sector is going to be the private sector, and they're going to try to do what's in their own interest. But we need those public investments, and we need them broadly. You know, we need them literally in broadband. We need them in our roads and bridges. We need them in our waterworks. We need it in our electrical grid. It'll make us a more competitive nation. It'll put people to work, and it will keep factories busy.
Yep.
And so I think that's an imperative. And, you know, plus it's good politics. I mean, people like for them. They think it's a good thing. And so I hope that they can continue building on that framework, get this thing passed and get a deal signed and overcome the political tendencies that I think some Republicans are going to have to not want to hand Biden any victory at all whatsoever on this, when the reality is this has been a bipartisan effort, and we've had some important allies along the way. Rob Portman of Ohio has done a great job, I will say. I mean, he's a retiring senator, but he's been fantastic on infrastructure and on issues like Buy American. And so I do think it's possible. But let's get to yes, let's get this thing passed, and let's get these projects started.
Because once we do that, you know, stories like where we started, you know, the reopening of the Sparrows Point are possible, that we can reopen some of our manufacturing facilities and we can create new ones. Because as I was reading through the article about this, you know, the Sparrows Point reopening, they're also talking about building a facility to do some additional work, I guess, that they say going to create about 3,500 construction jobs, as well as the jobs that were already coming from the workers, you know, making the steel for these wind turbines.
Yeah, it's a win-win. And this is the great thing about things like infrastructure and clean energy. These jobs are jobs that are going to benefit people who don't have or want a four-year college degree. Full stop. Black, white, and brown men and women. And that's the vast majority of this country. Most people will not have a fourth-year college degree. And these are the very folks who have fallen behind over the last couple of decades in this economy. And so having good jobs, investing in these priorities are going to create these construction jobs, are going to create these manufacturing jobs, and it will build a healthier, happier middle class. And that means stronger communities. And we've seen, I know you've seen it in Pennsylvania, I've certainly seen it too, and around the country, is the disintegration of these communities when you've seen this deindustrialization, this outsourcing, this attack on working people, and what it does to communities. And so having some restoration of this, I think, is vitally important for our national soul, in addition to just the good jobs that are going to be available.
No, we need to give them back good, solid manufacturing jobs. Get rid of the opioid addiction that's gripping these communities where the jobs aren't. That's how we recover from the crisis that we're in. We give people hope, opportunity, a way to lead a decent life and support their families. But it starts with policy, and the hope is we get this infrastructure bill done so we see more stories like this Sparrows Point story. Scott, as always, I appreciate the time, appreciate the work you guys do. Keep up the great stuff. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again real soon.
You bet. Right back at you, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1821. That was the day Uriah Smith Stevens was born near Cape May, New Jersey. Although he longed to be a Baptist minister, he worked as a tailor's apprentice and taught school. In 1845, he moved to Philadelphia. There, he became a member of the Garment Cutters Association in 1863, until it dissolved in 1869. From there, he joined several other garment cutters to form a new union. They called themselves the Knights of Labor. It was originally a secretive labor organization. Stevens' appreciation for religious ceremony infused the young union, which functioned like a fraternal order. Stevens took the title of first master workman of District Assembly 1 in the group. The organization would accept every worker, regardless of country of origin, race, religion, or trade affiliation. In fact, almost everyone was welcome to join, except for liquor dealers, lawyers, bankers, and professional gamblers. The Knights grew from just 9 members in 1869 to more than 9,000 by 1878. That year, Stevens became the Grand Master Workman, the top position in the organization. He soon resigned that position to become more involved in politics, but his organization continued to grow. It became the first national union to effectively organize across job types. In the 1880s, the union left behind its secrecy and became involved in the fight for the 8-hour workday. When the Haymarket tragedy occurred in Chicago, the Knights of Labor were caught up in the public backlash against organized labor. Although the group had no direct ties to Haymarket, its numbers plummeted. But the spirit of broad-scale worker organizing would live on in the United States, with organizing efforts such as the IWW and the CIO. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.